Hello and welcome to Social Creatures. I'm Kat Anderson, and this is the show that explores some of the most captivating success stories on social media. For today's episode, I'm chatting with Ramsey Risk.
You could almost say, and this sounds a bit excessive maybe, but like social networks are a basic human right. Networks and communities effectively are how we survived and thrived as a species, right? And that's been the case from day one.
Social media is a space for anyone, and really, nearly anything goes. But what is it that propels an account to the summit of success or popularity? Three seasons in, and I can honestly say that every story is unique, unpredictable, and fascinating. And digging into the why behind these stories is exactly what we're here for. Throughout the series, we'll be talking to the brains behind some of the best accounts you know, and hopefully some that you don't know yet. And new to this season, I'm going to be chatting with influencers who've achieved staggering success on social media, who are at the top of their game, and who are setting the trends. How the heck did they do it? Together, we'll uncover the way brands, organizations, and individuals have carved out their niche in the vast landscape of social media, and how you can do it too. Ramsey Risk defies definition. He has so many strings to his bow that I can hardly keep track. He's an angel investor, advisor, mentor, and founder of multiple businesses. But I think he's best described as someone who sits at the intersection of technology, psychology, and human connection. Ramsey began his journey in the corridors of academia, researching privacy on social media, a foundation that would ultimately shape where he is today. His path would see him venture out of the library and into entrepreneurship, becoming a prolific investor in over 35 companies. As well as investing in others, Ramsey is a serial founder himself. In fact, he has founded not one, not two, not three, but four businesses. And in one of those past businesses, we actually worked together. His latest venture, though, is about all things social. Specifically, the social connections we make ourselves. Dunbar is the newest social media platform aiming to build a professional networking platform. Though this series usually looks at how to succeed on existing platforms, today's episode flips the script as we examine the foundations of social media and what it can teach us about the future. Knowing Ramsey, I cannot wait to share with you what he has to say on this topic. Ramsey, I'm so happy to have you on the podcast today. Welcome to Social Creatures.
Really looking forward to this, Kat.
So Ramsey, you are the founder of Dunbar. Can you tell us what is Dunbar and why are you creating it?
Well, I mean, in as much as I can talk about it, because we're still kind of keeping a bunch of what we're doing under wraps, Dunbar is our attempt at empowering people to discover, nurture, and harness the full potential of their professional networks. Your professional network is probably one of the biggest contributors to professional success. Most people either have no access to the entire breadth of the people they know, the relationships they know, or no tools to maintain them, to nurture them, to monitor them, and to actually find the right person at the right time so that they can achieve their goals. And Dunbar wants to solve that problem for individuals and for teams.
What did you see that was absent to make you do this? Like, I know you have quite significant background in social media. You had a PhD candidacy in privacy in social media, is that correct? And then you also set up an online photography community. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your background in social media.
We're talking literally decades ago. I started doing my PhD in 07. After shifting around a few topics, I finally landed on this whole space called Web 2.0, right? And I've always been fascinated by social networks, also from a technical and scientific perspective, you know, how people connect and how these networks are shaped, and actually the physical shape of a network I find very interesting. And as I started researching, I realized that what this first generation of social networks was introducing was essentially a paradigm shift in how we deal with the internet. And I'm not the first to say this, and there's a lot of people that, you know, always talk about how Web 1.0 was read-only, and then Web 2.0 became read-write, you know, so people can actually publish easily and connect and reconnect. But I also realized during my research was that this paradigm shift was one that was not easy for everyone to understand, and not everyone to kind of grok the entire breadth of what it implies to have this data available to connect with others and so on. So my research kind of moved into privacy and that whole field, trying to look at it from technological perspective, which was in many ways the least interesting back then. And today there's a lot of technologies that are kind of privacy preserving and enhancing that are quite interesting, I would say. And then sociologically, which I also think is really, really interesting, because you could almost say, and this sounds a bit excessive maybe, but like social networks are a basic human right. Networks and communities effectively are how we survived and thrived as a species, right? And that's been the case from day one. We share our responsibilities, we share our triumphs, we commiserate. When things are bad, we help each other out. You know, we thrive as a society and as a community. And shifting that online introduced, I think, a lot of complexities, a lot of challenges. So I was really fascinated by that and then did a lot of research on privacy, how to preserve it, how to educate people. You know, purely distilled, the whole premise that I had in the end was we just need a new definition of privacy. Mm-hmm. And we need to educate people about what that new definition of privacy means. Because the old idea of privacy, meaning kind of the right to be let alone, which is a 150-year-old concept, I believe kind of went out the window as soon as social networks. There's no way you can preserve that privacy, but you need to educate people on what it means and what they're actually giving up in terms of information and what they're getting in return. IM was our baby. You know, me and my three co-founders, we built that company for 11 odd years. The four of us are all kind of passionate photographers. We're all fascinated by how mobile was growing. I personally, you know, I did the first community meetup for Flickr back in 2006 in Germany, right? I've been obsessed with communities and photography. And then we built this company to empower people both to learn from each other, to collaborate, to discover, and to actually effectively, in the end, hopefully make money off of their work. The community thrived. We grew to, I don't know, 30 million photographers over those years. I mean, you know, you were part of it as well. I think it was a beautiful journey where the photographers and the company and the team and the product were all kind of aligned in terms of values. And we had this warm, fuzzy feeling about it, which I still think of today as a very, very beautiful experience. Bottom line, social networks and communities online have and still play a big role in my life and my professional interests. And I think Dunbar came about for two main reasons. One is this realization of how important network is and the fact that it is almost a socioeconomic barrier in many ways. The people that understand how important networks are have effectively more opportunities and they have more advantages over the ones that don't. So that was one part of the driver of this is how I contribute. I contribute by empowering people to understand the full potential of their networks and to be able to leverage network to succeed. At the end of the day, I think you need to have a way where your network is in one place, aggregated, enriched and searchable and understandable and not be kind of dependent on any third party for it. So that's what we're trying to achieve.
So interesting, Ramsey, because I think there's a few different overlaps there, which almost seem contradictory. First of all, like your interest in privacy in the online space, on social media, but like online in general. Obviously, since 2007, that's a snowball that's kept rolling and kept getting bigger and bigger. And that's a huge issue now, as you know, and I'm sure you've watched it very keenly. But I think it's so interesting that this is also simultaneously held within someone who has really enjoyed growing online communities and sees the value of networking and of making sure that people have valuable connections. It's interesting that the company is called Dunbar as well, because this is based off Robin Dunbar's theory about human community, which is something that I actually believe I've referenced in other episodes of Social Creatures. So I love this, but can you share with the listeners what is that theory and why does it pertain to the stuff that you're doing in Dunbar?
Sure. Part of that work obviously has been disputed for a variety of reasons. At its essence, and it's usually typically distilled to Dunbar's number, which is that you can essentially maintain 150 relationships at any given moment. I don't necessarily believe that. The reason we're called Dunbar is multiple-fold. Again, one is it is a different approach to network, right? It's an approach that is driven by data and understanding and knowledge of your network rather than by just kind of posting stuff and sharing and communicating. So it's more about meaningful, strong, deep relationships and interactions, having that data to back it up. That is the main driver. Dunbar has a theory that kind of says your contacts are clustered in these growing circles. You have like the very, very small few people that are super close to, you know, these are your family and your, you know, absolute closest friends. And then there's a network of people that are strong contacts, you could say, And then there's 150 number, which is the people that you can put a face to that you know well enough. You know, this is kind of the number of relationships that you can maintain. And then beyond that, there's all of these contacts. We've gone through a bunch of iterations with the name. You know, at some point it was thinking rather calling it Dunbar because we want to grow that number by an order of magnitude through technology. Another one was about, this is more about quality, not quantity. It is more about just, you know, a data-driven, technology-powered approach to understanding and managing and maintaining and nurturing your network. And that's where we landed in the end. Interestingly enough, that 150 number has a lot of historic roots as well that are quite interesting. It used to be different societies, ancient tribes, where they split after they reached that number. Where so if the tribe grows beyond 150 people, they would split up into two tribes. And the premise being that beyond 150, you don't know everyone intimately anymore, which means that there's space for distrust, there's space for people taking advantage of each other and so on and so forth, which kind of unravels the fabric of that tribe or community. So they would split up to maintain that fabric, which I think is quite interesting. And to circle back to privacy, I think it was the other question, but maybe you want to dive into this a bit further as you wish.
Yeah, no, totally. Well, it's just, I think, the interesting overlap between the fact that privacy online is an issue that has only got bigger and more complex and honestly harder to deal with. And I think a lot of people who are interested in privacy online, a lot of the time it's not unusual to see them having a completely all or nothing approach. Well, most of the time, nothing, and really shutting off from using social media and from using online platforms where your data may be used. So I just think it's a very interesting overlap that you are interested in this, but also in a positive way, which is also driven by a love of building communities, a history of building very successful communities online, and wanting to really double down on that experience in a way, obviously, that respects people's data and wants to drive value. I guess, would you agree that that's quite unique from what you can see?
I've struggled to find someone who defines it properly, apart from that really old definition from 150 years ago, which is like the right to be let alone, the whole idea of being able to disconnect from the world and you're completely then isolated. And that came around in a way with the advent of photography being printed in newspapers, interestingly enough, and people did not want their photos showing up in newspapers. And that's kind of the whole thing started to take shape. Like I said earlier, in this day and age, privacy is the price of participation. Mm. And it's what you sacrifice in that sense if you want to be part of this global community, right? At least that old definition of privacy. And for me, the new definition is not about control, which is what it used to be. It is about knowledge, first and foremost, right? And I think this is something that we can solve for, meaning I need to know where my data is going. I need to know what's it being used for. I need to know who has access to my data. I cannot control it. You know, the minute I post something online, and we see this all the time, it's there, it's out there. Someone will find it somehow. I can delete it, I can scrub it, I can do whatever. The data is out there. You know, apart from completely going into the woods and living kind of a nomadic or you know, a hermit life, I don't think you can be private in that sense anymore. So you need to understand what tools there are, and you need to understand how you can have multiple personas. You know, things like crypto and Web3 are exploring really interesting premises. Now, whether that is the path forward or not is to be determined. But they are exploring different premises of, you might have different pseudonyms for different activities, but they all tie back to your same identity. So I don't think privacy and social media in that sense cannot coexist, right? You know, it's oxymoronic to say you can have privacy and still be on social media. I just think we haven't built the solutions yet. And the solutions need to be business aligned as well, right? That's a big part of it.
This is a good segue though then. So tell me a little bit about, what does the experience of Dunbar, what will it look like? What will it feel like? How would a user actually get value from it? So you've mentioned that you want to create a space where it can, and forgive me if I absolutely jump in and tell me if I've got this wrong, but amalgamate where all of our different networks exist in different places. As you mentioned, there's LinkedIn, there's WhatsApp, there's all of the different places where we're connecting with our broader network. Dunbar wants to amalgamate these, consolidate these into a place where you can derive real value and actually have meaningful connections through that. Am I right in thinking as well, you want it to be a place where you can genuinely, there's this real sense of reciprocity as well, where you can actually get help from people and help other people as well. So again, to that socioeconomic point, it's not just about getting, you know, 15,000 followers on LinkedIn. It's about having people who you actually know and actually can help. That's my broad understanding, but I still don't know what the look and feel. Tell me a little bit about like what your vision is for it.
I think one thing that's interesting to make as a distinction is the difference between a network and a social network in that sense, or at least social networks as we know them today, which are mostly about audience and publishing, right? If you think of LinkedIn, 15,000 followers, you're building up that audience that you can reach out to. What we're doing is we are allowing you to network professionally in an environment that helps you achieve your goals. Now, I can simplify it into a bunch of use cases that pretty much anyone listening will be familiar with. Let's say as a founder, one big thing you have to do all the time is hiring, right? You're kind of constantly looking to hire the best people. You get applications that are cold calls. You get recruiters maybe trying to find people and so on and so forth. But most of us have these contacts within our first or second degree network, right? We just don't have the tools to ask, and we don't have the tools to search the right way, right? Search is kind of one of these core fundamental things in your network that are entirely broken. I have no way to actually search for, let's say, software developers I know who live in New York because I'm flying over there next week and I want to have a meetup or whatever. There's no way for me to do that, which is kind of crazy in this day and age, right? And this is something that we want to solve for. When it comes to recruiting, one of the biggest challenges for most companies, it is shown, it's a fact that people that you hire through referrals, they tend to onboard faster. They cost less to hire, meaning, you know, less recruiter fees and so on and so forth. They tend to be happier. They tend to actually perform better and stay longer at the company. And everyone has this urge. You know, companies always, smaller companies always go like, you know, can you refer someone? If you know someone, they ask their team. And the team wants to help, but they don't have the tools to help. The company is willing to do the work, but they don't have the access to this network. Now imagine it is as simple as you working for a company, getting a notification saying, hey, Kat, you know XYZ, who would be a really great candidate for this position that we're hiring. Do you know them? Would you recommend them? Right? And it's one press. And that one click is all you need to do to actually refer someone to your company. Obviously, you would want to do it. There's a lot of, you know, consent built in and all of that. But that's one example. Think of sales. It's the same thing, right? A warm intro is much better than kind of cold outreach. And most people have that within their network. You know, you get hired into a company, especially as someone who's been around for a while. You have your contacts, you have your access, but there's no way for you to make that available to your company. There's no way for your company to make their network available to you. So this is now kind of how we're looking at it, right? Like these networks, they're there. They're enriched because we pull the data from everywhere and make sure that it's always up to date. It's your data, so you can obviously control to what degree who sees what. But at the end of the day, being able to make your network accessible is part of the beauty of what we're doing at Dunbar, right? So you could tell me, hey, I'd love to talk to some other people for future interviews. And all I would do is just give you access to my network of potential suitable people for the podcast, right? And then you'd be able to see them and you can ask me for an introduction. And to search for them, you don't have to come up with some filters and keywords and so on. You would literally just go and say, you know, people that might be a good match for the Social Creatures podcast. And that's all you would need to write, right? And that's kind of how we're trying to look at it. So it's more utility than social network, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows where it goes down the line, but it's not about posting an update and it's not about sharing photos or so on and so forth. It is about actually professional goals, achieving them, helping other people achieve their goals, seeing who you can help where, and reaching your entire network with a bit more certainty than, you know, what is reliant on an algorithm.
I love that. Would it be safe to say that Dunbar, without myself having ever planned to make a social media platform from scratch, you mentioned there that Dunbar has been created with utility at the core. That's obviously the function of Dunbar, but do you think that's where the other social media platforms maybe haven't been able to deliver that because they've maybe been built with desire maybe just to generate engagement and likes and to build up volume? Is that sort of what the core difference would be, do you think? Like, it's obviously the objectives are different, but I imagine it must be quite a different thing to set up when you're thinking about utility and driving actual value as opposed to just volume.
You know, again, it's definition of what value is. You know, if you're a thought leader and you want hundreds of thousands of people to read everything you post, then that is the value that you're looking to drive, right? And then something like LinkedIn would be a suitable place for you to do that, to build your audience and to engage your audience. If you look at what the issue is with most networks in that sense, I think a big chunk of it is simply the matter of a business model being misaligned in one way or another, right? We don't pay for most social networks. We don't pay to use them, right? So we're not exactly the customers. We're the product, which is fine. fine, again, if people understood it, which a lot of people don't, which is unfortunate. So those platforms have to optimize for the actual customers, the people that are paying, the people that are paying for eyeballs. Mm. So they have to optimize for volume, for engagement, for, you know, monthly active users and daily active users and number of likes, number of reposts, and so on and so forth. And that is a direct result of their business model being one that is about engagement and about advertising, right? It's the end, it's an advertising business model. In our case, we're going to charge for this. You're going to pay for this, which means on the one hand, it's a direct contract between the two of us, right? It's a direct contract that says we will deliver a service that you will find valuable and you'll pay for it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't find it valuable, then you won't, which obviously is our loss. I think it simplifies things, right? I think it's like a beautifully simple thing. You pay and I provide a service. You don't like the service, you don't pay. It's much simpler, maybe simplistic at this point, but I have high hopes for that, you know? And I think that people will be willing to actually pay. And there's a change, I think, in the sentiment globally, right? Around this whole idea of the entire internet is not free. And if it's free, then where's the catch, right? And we just don't want to have any catches in Dunbar.
Yeah, no, I completely get that. And I think you're right. I think we're increasingly even seeing the freemium products completely move away from just universal freemium access. But you know me, Ramsey, I am going to tower kick with you a little bit. Is having it as a paid service, in contrast to your earlier point about socioeconomic barriers to accessing networks, this is probably just a price point response, but having a platform that people have to pay for, yeah, there's a little tension there between the idea that certain socioeconomic classes might not be able to access the tools to create a stronger network. So I just wanted to poke you a little bit on that point.
Absolutely valid point. And it's obviously something that we've thought about and we've discussed. Again, at the end of the day, pricing is a whole big area of topics that need to be thought through. But in its simplest form, again, we're starting with an initial audience that is founders and investors and people in a certain part of the world and with a certain kind of level of career that they are able to afford it, right? You know, there are budgets, so companies can pay for this as well. It doesn't need to be the individual. There are budgets that go towards things like professional networking and like CRMs and like mm-hmm. whatever productivity tools and email tools and so on. So the money is there. Now, obviously, job seekers potentially would have Dunbar for free for the purposes of them kind of finding a job. You know, there's a lot of ways to explore that would make it accessible. You know, fresh graduates might have it for free because they're very interesting for potential employers, and potential employers might subsidize it. So there's going to be ways to solve for this problem, right? And at the end of the day, you know, I think people are paying for things like Netflix and Spotify, and they're paying for a whole bunch of services here and there. So it won't be priced out of scope for anyone who would benefit from it. And again, day one, and then we'll figure it out as we go.
For sure. I'm just stress testing you a little, but I agree with your point. It does make me think, obviously, pricing is one part of one of the things you have to consider, but sort of setting up a social media platform from scratch is a significant undertaking. You are on the brink of releasing, is that correct?
Well, we're starting to let some people in from our close circles and our networks to start using it. Yeah, so we're getting there.
Presumably then that journey from ideation, it's progressed quite far. Can you tell me about what some of the challenges were that you faced when sort of taking this conceptually to an actual product, and how did you overcome them?
You know, end of the day, you need to get it in the hands of the people that need it and see how they're using the product, how they're actually utilizing the functionality. And then we kind of iterate on that. We obviously did a lot of user research, a lot of experimentations. We ran through a bunch of prototypes, tested internally, externally. You know, in this case, one benefit is that the initial target audience that we're building for is ourselves in many ways, which brings with it certain benefits. You know what you want and what you need. Obviously, there's a lot of thought that went through between founding and now. There's a lot happening in technology, you know, broadly, you know, around AI in particular, with kind of a lot of these LLMs becoming mainstream, a lot of these foundational models and so on. And so we obviously explored what that meant and took all that into consideration. I think the interesting part of this is what you said initially, which is, you know, building I wouldn't call it social media platform per se, but I think what you're referring to is this empty room problem. And since we're not building a social network, it almost doesn't exist, right? It's a single player product that you can use by yourself. you can, you know, then think of it as just a really, really smart, well-connected, highly technologically powered address book, which you don't need to have anyone else using it for you to draw value from that, which kind of nullifies the whole empty room problem, if you want, right? So you start using Dunbar and you're already seeing value in that it's surfacing people that are relevant based on your calendar, based on your interactions, based on what you're trying to achieve at work, based on, I don't know, jobs that your company is hiring for. And, you know, from that, you can start actually probably telling people or inviting people to join, you know, so there's some really interesting built-in mechanisms there. I think that was the interesting one to figure out, mm-hmm. which is why we're an aggregator of data in the beginning. You know, at some point you want to be the source of truth. You want people to just look at you and go like, okay, this is where my identity lives online. But in the beginning, you just can't do that without risking, obviously, this empty room thing and trying to have to growth hack your way into some level of critical mass and of people using it, right? But we saw no need to actually burden ourselves with that.
Yeah.
So we have all of the data, you have your networks and you have your access and you draw all the benefit that you want initially. And as more people join, there are more ways to collaborate, which, you know, the cherry on top.
I think that's so interesting. Obviously, for a service that is valuing quality over quantity, it's great to hear that you're protective over, as you say, growth hacking just to a critical mass. Like, that's not what the goal is. But maybe you could tell me, what is the goal? So what's an ideal state for Dunbar in, say, 5 years' time? And how do you think about, you know, again, ideal state, what does scale look like for Dunbar?
That's a really, really interesting question to answer without being full of pomp and circumstance. You know, I could say we want to be the platform for your professional network, right? Everyone who is on a professional journey needs to be using Dunbar. But end of the day, having been through the entrepreneurial journey a bunch of times now and having made all of these learnings, I think for me, I like to kind of break it down to individuals, right? I like to break it down to, you know, the founder that's founding their company for the very first time and wants access and doesn't understand that you just need one person and that person opens up the entire ecosystem up to you and you don't need to give up so much equity to do that, right? The people trying to find a job in a company that their values aligned with and have no way in until they realize, oh, this one person that works there went to the same school and studied under my professor, and my professor can make that intro. You know, I think it's these individual stories that are the beauty of what we're trying to achieve here. And sure, you know, obviously that's kind of part of it, part and parcel. But I don't know. I struggle answering this question. It's almost like when you're fundraising the first time and the VCs ask you, what do you want to achieve? And the only answer you can give is, you know, I want to be a $1 billion company or I want to IPO, even though 99.9% of the companies never achieve either. It feels like a cop-out answer, right? I just feel like there is a way to make this world more equitable. And you do that not by dragging everyone down to kind of the same level of misery, but by pulling everyone up to the same level of access and opportunity. And if we contribute a small part to that, that would be basically all I could hope for.
I think it's absolutely fair to have a little bit of ambition if you're setting something up. But I love that your answer isn't 100% mercenary. I also would completely forgive you if your answer was 100% mercenary, because I'd say for a lot of businesses, you know, even businesses that are doing wonderful things, you have to make money to survive. But I think that was an honorable answer and you handled it well.
Well, obviously, we want to build a viable, successful business, right? That goes without saying. But that's every business. Every business you're building has to be a viable, successful business that is profitable, that is generating revenues,
yeah,
that is growing, right? But it's about how you get there. And I think we get there by creating value and by helping people. And if we achieve that, then we will achieve the latter, right? I thought it's more interesting to talk about why I hope for Dunbar to succeed and why I wanted to do this from the beginning, right? But obviously, it's a business. And at the end of the day, a business is measured by specific numbers, right? And we're not hiding away from that. We're not shying away from that. And this is not a charity, right? As simple as that. That is not the purpose, right? There's 1,000 other businesses that we could have started and work on. And this is one. I mean, both me and my co-founder, who you also know, we're both essentially immigrants, right? We both came from different countries to Germany, and we both learned our different ways how important network was and how important it was to actually kind of mindfully approach it and understand how to leverage it and how to nurture it, not to shy away from it. We learned that, but not everyone has to go on a 10-year journey to learn it as well, right? Like, this is something we can just give people that access and those resources and tools. I think we will do something really good and we would be helping people the right way, I would say.
I think that is really admirable. I've thought a couple of times with your answers, it's clear that you can see almost like past iterations of yourself who would have benefited from this product.
100%.
And I think just that final point about how you have achieved this, maybe despite not having all of those networks, you know, being an immigrant, that's very refreshing, because I think you're directly going against, you know, survivorship bias, where you're like, if I can do it, anyone can do it. You're sort of saying, no, actually, I did get through. I did manage to cut through here and have a very successful career, but it was hard. And actually, we can make this easier for people because it's not something that just everyone can achieve. Would you say that's a fair position?
Yes. I mean, to a certain extent, right? I like to say something which is not always very popular, but I like to say that the game is not rigged. We just don't know the rules. In many cases, obviously the game is rigged sometimes, but in many cases, just because you don't understand the rules doesn't mean the game itself is rigged.
Mm.
I have simple examples of this every single day, right? A friend with a company who's asking me to look at a pitch deck for something they're building, and they're shying away from it. And then I'm trying to tell them, well, listen, you need to understand that VCs live off of deal flow. They need to see these deals, you know? So if I am sending a pitch deck over to an investor, I'm kind of doing them a favor, almost not even doing you a favor. And then you see a first-time founder who's not even, who thinks that, you know, they're too shy to ask because they think then, you know, you're doing them a favor instead of it being the other way around. And this is like one of those really simple examples where people don't understand necessarily the incentive structures. They don't necessarily understand how this thing works. You know, so if you can level the playing field a little bit, I think you will just give way more people, you know, many more opportunities and, you know, just provide them with a faster, let's say, ramp up into entrepreneurship as one of the cases, right? Because that's what we're starting with. But the same goes for finding a new company to invest in, or finding investors for your company, or finding, you know, potential customers or, you know, whatever it is that you're looking for. Make those incentives clear and make it as easy as possible for people to help you, and give you the tools to understand that asking for help is not a bad thing and that reciprocating is a good thing. And then also giving you the tools to potentially remember people at the right time, at the right place, which is another one of those big challenges, right? Someone asked me, oh, you know, do you know anyone whose friend the other day was like, I'm looking for a graphic designer. I was like, I could not think of a graphic designer to save my life, which is crazy, right? But being able to actually look them up real quick and connect them that way, I've done this person a favor, I've done that person a favor, I've deposited social capital into all parts of my network, and at some point, this will pay back in spades. I truly believe in that, right? It is reciprocal. So giving people the tools to do this is step one towards helping them succeed professionally and kind of achieve their goals.
I love that, because in this season of the podcast, we are actually publishing a poll asking our listeners a question on Sprout's social media accounts ahead of each episode. And this is just to bring a little bit of insight from our listeners into our conversation. And for this episode, we asked, what aspect of social media do you value the most? And so I will tell you the answers, but I'm interested in how you think they're going to skew. So the three options we gave people were the number of followers or likes, meaningful connections, or entertainment and content. So, Ramsey, which way do you think the results would have skewed?
Interesting, because I think most people would then probably think of the second, just because nobody wants to admit that it's the first or the third. So I would say the second one got the most votes, followed by the third, followed by the first. So meaningful connections, then entertaining content, then followers. But in reality, it's probably exactly the other way around.
Oh, so I love that take, because you're completely right. So 53% of our audience, and this was actually one of the polls that was most engaged with. So 53% of people said that meaningful connections was what they valued the most. 43%, so very hot on its heels, was entertainment and content. And then just 5% was number of followers and likes. I actually think it's a pretty hot take, but I could definitely see that the truth might be people want to see the followers and likes, but it's a little bit of a cynical take, Ramsey. Do you think people are not, they're not interested in meaningful connections? Wait,
of course it is.
What's your read of that?
I think we all crave meaningful connections. I think it's you know, something that we intimately and intensely and kind of,
yeah,
it's in our DNA. Like, we crave that. We need that, right? I think in many cases on social networks, what you're getting is more kind of a superficial hit of dopamine that mimics this meaningful connection. again, the problem boils down to, again and again, the business model, right? If you have a business model that is geared towards making you connect meaningfully with people, that gives you an enriched experience, then you would be able to actually get those meaningful connections. But those come at the cost of not having 20,000 followers and not having 500 likes on every story you post. So I think it's an either or, right? I'm not saying right or wrong, good or bad. I just think it's an either or. And models right now, the business models right now, just do not really allow for or optimize for these more meaningful connections, right? And again, I think a lot of the stuff that is on social is entertaining, and I think it's great to be entertained. I think a lot of the FOMO stuff is bad for us, and we can't help it because it's a bit of an addictive thing that goes on there. But like, the optimist in me just sees all of the ingredients that we need in place right now to reinvent how we network and how social networks work and make them more in line with what we actually want. You know, there's a reason why people go on detox from social networks. You know, they love the experience, they love the interaction, but then they go and drop off for a month. I have a couple of friends that actually do it for Lent, which I find quite hilarious. So there's a reason people do that, right? And that break is healthy. But I believe in a world where you don't need that break. I believe in a world where the social network mimics your personal network. And when you're a little bit depleted, you don't need to go on. You can just not interact. And you need interaction and you can go and interact, just like in real life, right? But for that, the products need to be geared towards those kind of interactions, the ones that are mutually beneficial. And that would require a change in business models. At the core of it, I think that's what is needed. Now, audience building and reaching an audience is a great thing. Being able to create amazing content and sharing that with a broad audience is a beautiful thing, right? It's media. It's a new form of media. And there's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with that. But when you start creating random content just to kind of, you know, farm for likes and comments in order to game that system, that's where it just gets very fluffy, very noisy. And there's a lot of the, you know, there's just so much noise, so little signal, and a lot of the value is lost in it, right? You know, that's how I see the whole thing. You know, it's a jaded take. And LinkedIn is just like any other social network in that sense, interestingly enough, that it has become that. It didn't used to be. I think a little bit with all of the exodus from other networks, they're just framed maybe in a bit more of a professional setting. So instead of here are the five getaway destinations you should go to in photos, it's like here are the five things you need to do before waking up every morning in order to maximize your productivity and take over the world, right? And it's the kind of the same kind of content that is almost automatically generated and so on and so forth. But wherever you look on all of these networks, at a certain point, you realize that quality content wins over. And the people that are creating quality content are not like farming necessarily. They are genuinely creating stuff that they believe in. They are sharing material that they thought through, that they've worked hard on. And, you know, I mean, let's not go deeply into this, but all of this other stuff, I think, will be very easily replaced by machines very soon.
Yeah.
Because if it's not creative, not personal, not meaningful, not thought through, I can automate it. But the deep, meaningful stuff, that won't be, right? So one way or another, we will end with these intimate, meaningful networks and everyone will be healthier and happier and better off because of it.
I actually completely agree with you because I think we've already seen social media go through a number of evolutions since its inception. You know, as you alluded to, you know, in the late 2000s, people were just throwing everything up online as if, as you said, they were just sitting in their living room without that real understanding of this is forever and this is globally accessible. And I think we've got a new generation of digital natives now. I think it's going to continue to evolve because people don't like the real, you know, mass-produced stuff. So I completely share your position. But it's interesting you talk about what needs to change because you did write a blog post entitled "It's Time to Reinvent Social Networks." And within that, you had written that social networks need to be built on two foundations, agency and alignment, which are two interesting words. Could you expand on that?
Alignment is what I've been talking about all along, right? Which is that the business needs to be aligned with the customers and we need to be the customers if we're talking social networks, right? Because then we can vote with our feet, right? And agency is about control as well. Agency is about not being locked in. You know, the number of people that say, I'm leaving this network, I'm leaving that platform and so on and so forth. But we don't leave because we've invested so much time. We're afraid to lose our contacts, our relations. We're afraid to lose people that mean a lot to us, but the access to whom is somehow limited and controlled by the social network. And by agency, I mean, again, in whatever way, shape, or form, it is about, I need to be able to control my network. And if I leave, I need to be able to take my network with me. And again, whether that's a decentralized thing or whether there's some sort of contract with these providers that allows me to export, import, I just find it pretty simple to solve all of these problems if you have these two factors, right? They kind of coexist, right? They're symbiotic in a way, because if I have control over my network and if I have access to my contacts and you can't lock me in, then your service better be good and you better compete on providing a better product, which means we need to be aligned as a customer and as a service provider. And if we are aligned, then I have access to my data. So they kind of go hand in hand.
Finally, my question today is something that, again, we're asking all of our guests, which is, what advice would you give to our listeners or perhaps any aspiring entrepreneurs looking to disrupt or innovate within the realm of social media or technology? Do you have any strategies as someone who has been a successful entrepreneur a couple of times now, someone who's also an investor, any strategies that you've seen to be consistently successful?
Broadly, and again, might be a bit of a cop-out, it is authenticity. I think that is the one thing that just shines through whatever form it may take. You see a lot of brands that are trying hard to go in one direction because they sense, oh, this is not popular, let's go into memes. And it's like, but that doesn't really fit. That's not your voice. And you see a lot of brands that, you know, lean into the boring nature of their business and it works. You know, I think authenticity and knowing who you're talking to, you know, it's just basic. I've been looking a lot at these, you know, massive influencers and how they're building products after building their audience, which I think this whole thing is a very, very interesting space to explore, right? Someone like Mr. Beast, you know, there's so many people that are trying to copy the style in a way, but dude's authentic and it comes across. And I might be naive here, but like, because it comes across, it works. It carries over. It only does that because it's real. So being authentic and being true to yourself and standing up for something and actually not being afraid to be controversial, but also not pushing controversy just because it's hip now to be controversial. Mm-hmm. I think that's what works, right?
From someone who's interested in psychology, I would love to just go into that a tiny bit more because I completely agree with you. But I think authenticity is a word that's almost become hackneyed and overused. But at the same time, I don't think there's anyone who doubts what you've just said. I would love to just get your thoughts on that and then also why it's so hard. Why do you think it's so hard for so many people to authentically be themselves?
I'm not an expert on neuroscience. I'm not an expert on human brain. I'm not an expert on psychology or marketing or authenticity, but this is my personal opinion. So take it with a grain of salt. That's why we compare our brains or machine learning models and so on to our brains, neural networks and so on, is that a lot of the stuff is happening in the background. It's kind of abstract. You don't necessarily know why certain things happen. I don't know if you've read Thinking Fast and Slow, Daniel Kahneman, where there's a lot of stuff that is just a snap reaction. That's years of experience, years of observations that you can't necessarily go and explain away. I can't necessarily, you know, have this causal chain that goes back from, oh, this is why I don't believe it. It's just a gut feeling. So I think it's just based on all of these experiences that we've made and all of the observations that we've made. Can't really explain it. It is obviously overused. You're absolutely right. And I think the brands that, or the individuals that do it well, they don't shy away from being themselves. And I think this is a big part of it. I would say being authentic does not just mean being honest or being real or being true. It's also being true to yourself, which is quite hard. From my own personal experience, so many times, you know, growing up and you know, and throughout my career, where I would shy away from saying what I think for whatever reason. And at some point, something clicked and I felt more comfortable and definitely less shackled by whatever burdens, societal norms, and so on that held me back. And I like to think that my voice and the authenticity that I was speaking through came across at that point. And I see it in a lot of others. You know, there's a reason we're both into comedy, right? There's a reason why one comedian being mean is funny and another comedian being mean is not. Their authenticity shines through. And you know that one of them is just punching down to be mean to someone and trying to get cheap laughs. And the other is actually the exact same situation, exact same setup, exact same punchline. But the other one is genuinely laughing with the person, right? Laughing at the person, laughing with the person. I think these are all kind of in the same realm. Maybe a bit too abstract of an answer, but that's how I look at it.
Well, Ramsey, thank you so much for this. I feel like, well, I have sat for hours talking to you in the past. I'm sure I will do it again. But thank you so much for this. I've completely loved talking to you, and I'm sure our listeners will as well.
Thank you, Kat. It was fun. Let's do it again soon.
You've been listening to Social Creatures with me, Kat Anderson. Many thanks to Ramsey for joining me today, and a special thank you to Sprout Social for making this podcast possible. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to let us know on social media at Sprout Social, and subscribe to hear other episodes like this wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks.